And it's time to say Nollie Connor to Dr. Joe Kelly. Imagine why, Dr. Kelly, on Walter Gamay.
Imagine why, good day. August the Loch Dish, Jack. Good morning to yourselves and all in Highland Radio.
Okay, it's that wonderful time of the year, isn't it, Dr. Joe? Christmas. Are you a Christmas person? You've got a Christmas jumper, huh?
Absolutely. Well, we have the Christmas festive day here in the school. And so there's going to be plenty crack now later on after lunch. But obviously, I have young children, so Santa is busy. And so there's plenty of excitement that way. But no doubt for others, it's maybe not as joyful as that. There maybe is an empty space at the table for many this Christmas, or there are other things, one kind or another. But look, Christmas gives us eternal hope, and we should never lose that sight of that. You know, on the 21st of December, it's the shortest day of the year. And the pagans historically used to celebrate that as Sol Inveticus, because they believed that the sun switched down and then after 21st of December would turn back up again, get strong. So it was the invincible sun. That was the feast they had. And then obviously we Christianized it to some extent. Sol Inveticus, Natalis Sol Inveticus, the birth of the invincible sun, which is our faith in Jesus and all that that goes with it, with the celebration of Christmas. So there's always hope. Mm-hmm.
I sometimes think stories and traditions, even when they're documented in things like the Bible, can be a little bit like Chinese whispers, in that so much time has passed that subtle changes can happen over the years. And then we find ourselves in a place hundreds or thousands of years later, and that Chinese whisper has changed the narrative somewhat. So I think it's an opportunity maybe for us to dig down into what actually Christmas is, Christmas actually is. And I remember there used to be a big pushback as we moved to a more commercial Christmas, as religion sort of seemed to take a back seat, that the birth of Jesus Christ began to take a little bit of a back seat. There used to be a pushback on that, and I think sometimes to some extent people have thrown their hands up now and said, you know, we can't hold the wave back. But, you know, here in the 9 till noon show, we're going to do our bit. So for me, my childhood, and I wonder, is it the same for children now, the nativity scene, it was Christmas, you know what I mean? It was part and parcel of Christmas. It was to the forefront. So, you know, like, what is it depicting and how accurate is it, Dr. Joe?
Well, interesting question. And the first thing is, what we know about Christmas is very scant, really. There's four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, and only Luke and Matthew actually describe the birth of Jesus. So only two out of the four Gospels detail that. And that's understandable, because if we were to example, we're going to write about Michael Collins, do we know who was there when he was born, who came in, if it was at home or in the hospital, you know, what presents people brought? That information would not necessarily be available now. And so when Luke, for example, when he wrote the gospel, he didn't know Jesus. Jesus was dead. So when he was writing the gospel, we believe he must have talked to Mary or Lady to get some insight. And Matthew as well would have known the tradition that went around it in the stories. So both Matthew and Luke give us two accounts, and some of them differ. The two accounts actually differ, but they're quite short. You'd read them in about 3 or 4 minutes. And yet this is what we've spent our whole Christmas for the last 2,000 years celebrating and interpreting it. So, for example, if you were to ask Greg, you know, how many wise men, people would always say three. Well, it actually doesn't say that in the scriptures. It doesn't tell us what age Joseph was. It doesn't tell us many things, you know, the exact date that Jesus was born.
Room at the inn, is that referenced?
Yes, there is. That's referenced. But again, it has to be contextualized, because what happened was a census was decreed, and that's a historical fact. It was a census for the whole of the Roman Empire. And the way the Jews did it, there's 12 families in the Jews, 12 tribes, and every Jew knows which tribe they belong to, even to this day. And the family of Jacob, there's 12 sons. And so the way the Jews did was, when they would do a census, they would return to their home village of their ancestor. So could you imagine all the Hugheses congregating in Ireland in Donegal town, all the McBrides, say, coming to Gador, all the O'Dohertys coming to Buncrana? There'd be thousands and thousands of people in that one space in that one time. So obviously there wasn't space in the end, not just for Mary and Joseph, but for countless others as well. So you have to put everything in its context when reading it. Yeah.
So who is in? So when we talk of the first Christmas, we are talking the day Jesus Christ was born, I presume. And just quickly on the date, was that December 25th? Or you've settled on December 25th?
It was settled on the 25th, and then we talked just earlier there about the Solemnificus, which was a pagan festival in Roman Empire, 21st of December. So when Christmas wasn't celebrated until about, originally until about 525, around that time, Dionysius was as a monk, and he was given the job of trying to find out the date, and he settled on the 1 AD and on the 25th of December, and that tied in with the pagan festival. But look, I don't think that is, it was the 25th of December. That's just a date that was settled on, and there's nothing in neither Luke or Matthew that details that to us. So, but the first Christmas, as it's described in Luke and in Matthew, they give us characters, and I think that if we look at the characters, we begin to understand Christmas in a more authentic and meaningful way. So who were the people that were around the crib? Who were the people that came and visited? What were they, you know? And
so what do Luke and Matthew tell us then in that regard?
Well, the thing is, first of all, again, people must begin to realise that the Gospels weren't written for children. And they weren't written for chronology, just to give you facts and details. They were written for adults to get them to reflect, to understand the first Christmas, and at a spiritual and philosophical, theological level. So who were the characters? Obviously, there was Jesus and Mary, and we could spend a whole show talking about them. And maybe we'd look at the other characters and refer back to them. But Joseph, for example, is in very much prominent in the story. And Joseph doesn't actually speak. There's no words Joseph says in either Luke or Matthew. There's no words. So how do we find out what Joseph actually was happening? And what we understand was he obviously was a carpenter, and we believe that actually Joseph was possibly, now we're not sure, but possibly married before, because it does say in scriptures later on that Jesus had four brothers and possibly two sisters. So how is that possible if we believe as Catholics and Christians that Mary was ever virgin, that they teach all that? So where did the children come from? And what is believed is that Joseph's first wife possibly died, and that Mary helped out. She was about 15, around that age. And it was agreed that she would be betrothed to him, that she would marry him. 16 was the normal age for getting married. Remember, at that time, they didn't live to nearly beyond 40. So life was short, cruel and brutal. And there was no secondary school or national school. There was none of that. It was more or less grown up very, very fast. And that was the culture of the time. And so Joseph was betrothed to her, engaged to her, and obviously she was helping out in some way while he was carpentering, maybe looking after other children that he had had from the previous marriage that his wife had died. We're not sure, but this is speculation. But he finds out then she's pregnant, and he says, well, hold on a minute, this wasn't me. I know this wasn't me. This isn't. So he had three choices, either to marry her, to divorce her, go to the church authorities, which would have been common practice, and say, look, something's happened here. I've been played offside, and I want a divorce, which would have been very public. But what he settled on, he was a just, but he was also a kindly, merciful man, and didn't want to bring a terrible embarrassment to the young girl. So he decided to divorce her privately and probably give her back to her parents and say, look, she's pregnant and it's nothing to do with me. And so what happens, Joseph, in the scriptures, and Luke tells us and Matthew, that while he's asleep, an angel Gabriel appears to him and tells him, look, this is the work of God. This is the fulfillment of the prophecy of the Old Testament. Take Mary as your wife, marry her. And so what happens is the next morning he wakens up, he decides to marry her.
So the angel speaking to Joseph, that's a critical part then of the Christmas story, obviously.
Well, it's even more powerful than that. And I have a statue myself of the sleeping Joseph. Some people may have it. It's a Joseph lying down flat sleeping. And even today in modern psychological terms, you know, God can speak to us in our living days, but also he can speak to us in our sleep. And that's very profound, because later on in the gospel, when the massacre of the innocents, when Herod finds out that just Jesus Messiah is born, he wants them killed. So he sends his army down to Bethlehem to kill all Jewish children under two. It's called the Massacre of the Innocents. And Joseph gets another dream from the angel Gabriel, and he gets up and leaves and goes into Egypt. So his sleep is seen as very, very much part of the Christmas story, that God speaks to us in our sleep. And that's
take us at that stage, right? So at the time, from what we know from the Bible and what have you, you know, so Jesus is only about to be born at this point. Who would Joseph have imagined? There was still a God at that point, was there? Or who would Joseph would have imagined was guiding him? Because there's no organized Catholic religion, obviously, or Christian religion.
But see, the first Christian is Jesus.
And that's what I'm saying. So I wonder who he believed was guiding him.
Joseph was a Jew, Mary was a Jew, Jesus was a Jew. Everybody in that, more or less, apart possibly from the wise men, they were all Jews. And okay. There were two types of people in the world at that stage. You're either a Jew or a non-Jew, and the word for non-Jew was a Gentile. So Joseph was a Jew, Mary was a Jew, and they were deeply, deeply aware of the Old Testament because that's what they had, and the prophecy of the Messiah to come. The Jews are still waiting for the Messiah. As Christians, we believe that Jesus is the fulfillment of that Messiah, but the Jews are still expecting a Messiah. Mm-hmm. And we as Christians say in our creed, he will come again to judge the living and the dead. So we believe Jesus is going to come back again. And when he does come back, the Jews are going to be correct.
And the Jews wouldn't have accepted, obviously, given the slaughter of the innocents, etc. This would have seen as an affront to their religion, almost sacrilegious, potentially.
Well, yeah. And look, the way they've seen it is that their expectation is of Jesus or God coming in all his glory and his might. This was Jesus or God coming in very humble circumstances with no power. The fact that he was even crucified, that he didn't try to rescue himself or bring an army of angels. So for the Jews, they are more into the triumphal coming of their Messiah. Mm-hmm. And that's what we do believe, as even as Christians, that he will come again to judge the living and the dead. And at that end, so there's two, the word in Greek is soteriology. It's the last things in eschatology, what happens at the end of times. So there's different visions, but believe it or not, they end up joining up. Both the Christian, the Muslim, and the Jewish religion have nearly the same direction at the end of
them. Which is quite remarkable. John the Baptist's parents are mentioned, Zechariah and Elizabeth, because you talk the wise men aren't mentioned, right? And everyone's familiar with them. But Zechariah and Elizabeth are, I wonder, just maybe sort of casual Christians or non-Christians may not be aware of that. So what is their role according to either Luke or Matthew?
Well, Zechariah was a Levite priest, so he was a Jew and he was practicing the temple, and his wife Elizabeth, and they were of old age, past childbearing age, and it was the highest sacerdotal privilege you could get was to go into what they called the Ark of the Covenant, where the Ten Commandments were kept behind a veil in the temple. Now, you've got to understand the temple in Jerusalem, and part of it's still there, the Wailing Wall, was about 10 times the size of Crow Park, and it was massive. And so every 2 weeks, each tribe of priests got to get a turn to go to the temple and to go in behind the veil where the Ark of the Covenant was to offer sacrifice and perfumes and to trim the candles and to clean and so forth. And you had to walk in and walk backwards. At no time were you allowed to turn your back to the Ark. And it was his turn on this occasion. And when he was there, the angel appeared to him, told him he was going to have a child, which would be later John the Baptist. And he says, how is this possible? My wife is beyond childbearing. And the angel Gabriel says, look, nothing's impossible to God. And then what happens is he's struck dumb. He can't speak. And he comes out from behind the veil, shaking and silent. And he doesn't get to speak. His voice isn't freed until he says this will become, you know, the baptism or the presentation of the temple, that this is, his name will be John the Baptist. And he was a cousin of Jesus. And Mary, when the Annunciation happened and she was told, look, you know, God has highly favoured you, you're to have a child. And she said yes to all this and said, by the way, your cousin Elizabeth or your kinswoman Elizabeth is also 6 months pregnant. And Mary rushes off to see her. So this all ties in. And when Mary meets Elizabeth, it says in the Bible, John the Baptist and Jesus, John the Baptist turns in her womb, jumps. And it's like Jesus meeting John the Baptist. And John the Baptist is the person who goes out before Jesus 30 years later to tell the world that the Messiah is here. He makes straight the road and saying the Messiah is here. And John the Baptist loses his head later on. But that's the story of Jesus and John the Baptist. They're related, and how Mary went. So I would imagine after that, Mary came back to Nazareth, and it was at that point possibly Joseph had realized, look, this young girl is pregnant and it's not to my doing. So it's the chronology of all that. But they were very, very simple, and Elizabeth did get pregnant, so nothing was impossible to God. And for Jews, not having children was seen as a God's punishment, or you'd done some sin or something wrong. And thank God we've come a long way from that, but it was seen as something that was
an infliction of some description. Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
stay with me, Dr. Joe Kelly. We're talking about Christmas. We've got loads more to talk about. You're okay for another 10 or 15 minutes? You are okay. Time's not an issue this morning. We'll take a break of loads of questions. They're stacking up behind my eyes, and I'll get them to Dr. Joe Kelly after these. We're in conversation with Dr. Joe Kelly, our historian in residence, and we are sort of reflecting on Christmas, and we're going right back to the birth of Jesus Christ, and also talking about how it is reflected in the Bible. Only Luke and Matthew wrote about it. It's a short enough piece, and there's bits been added in, I think, over the course of the years. We talked about the wise men. I might come back to them briefly, but I'm just curious as to the shepherds and their role in this. Also, sort of, you know, everyone who's familiar with the Nativity will be sort of familiar with the shepherds. Do they have a more, tangible role?
Well, it's, again, as I said to you earlier on, and it's a very good question that you've asked, the Gospels were written for adults, and they were written for them to comprehend at a deeper level, a spiritual level, a philosophical level, a theological level, what really God was trying to say through the Nativity. And the shepherds are really romanticized, and there's a lovely, you know, beautifulness about it, and particularly with children and nativity plays, you know, that they have the shepherds and the sheep. And it's something very, very significant in our understanding of Christmas. But what's important about the shepherds theologically is, first of all, they were on the lowest strata of society. They didn't own land. They were working for someone else. And they were the lowest of the low, if that would make sense to you. And yet the angels appear to them, and the theological significance of that is that God didn't really care who you are or what you are. He would communicate with the lowest of the lowest in society. And Luke makes that point very clear. And like later on, Luke comes more unhinged in cultural terms from the time, because he is Jesus meeting with prostitutes and sinners and tax collectors.
So when we see the current popes and what have you washing people's feet, yeah, or washing prostitutes' feet, or whatever the yeah, correct terminology is now and again, this is all linked back to that way of thinking, yeah, I presume then. So.
Yeah, because again, at that time, you could imagine culturally, they were very judgmental. We talked about Our Lady being pregnant and divorced publicly. That would happen. That was a normal culture at the time. So prostitutes, as you mentioned, and tax collectors, the homeless, all those kind of people, lepers, they were more or less disassociated, because blessing was seen as wealth, particularly in the Jewish concept of barak is the Hebrew word. Word for it. And to have barak was God's blessing, and where you weren't blessed, then that was seen as a curse. You must have done something wrong. And here's God, so to speak, entering into earth through the person of Jesus Christ, being born in a stable, cave, and he didn't come to the wealthy, he didn't come to a castle, he didn't come to the learned of universities. He came to the humblest,
and it's interesting, because if you were trying to pitch this story, right, say at that time you were trying to pitch it, this is not what you would do. You would not, exactly. You would not pitch it to those who would be seen as the lowest in society, and the you wouldn't, you know, I mean, you would choose a different set of characters, which I think is quite interesting.
That's a brilliant insight, because, and I'm going to contradict myself a wee bit here, but St. Patrick, when he came to Ireland, although he spread Christianity throughout Ireland, and he's known for that, but what he did was he went to all the high kings or the kings and converted them, and then that trickled down, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is quite correct. That's the way St. Patrick actually worked when he tried to Christianize Ireland or spread Christianity in Ireland. But in the Bible, we find that God works from the bottom up, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And the other theological significance of the shepherds was when the angels did appear to them, they were willing to react to what God had said to them. So Joseph had done that, Mary had done that, Zachariah and Elizabeth had done that. And here we have again the shepherds responding and say, let's go to Bethlehem, let's go and look for this child. So they're the first people that God communicates, and they're the first people that see the child. And I think that's, you know, theologically very, very significant.
You can see why the powerful would like to suppress this, though. You don't want the people rising. You don't want them having, you know, a leader, in inverted commas. Yeah. You don't want them getting uppity. Yeah. So you can imagine what the ruling classes thought of this at the time.
Well, again, they were ignorant of what was going on until we talked in a while about the wise men. They didn't realise this was going on, the ruling classes. This was something very, very humble. And I love that song. There's different versions of it. Oh, Little Town of Bethlehem with Frank Sinatra was a lovely version of it. And it talks about how silently the gracious gift is given. This happens very quietly. God works in very, very quiet ways. And again, the Nativity story is a very, very quiet story. It's not something grandiose. It's not something that's, you know, dressed up in gold and royalty. It's something very, very, very simple and very earthed. And so, that's, again, the theology behind it.
Yeah, when Jesus then later was presented in the temple, two older people came up to Mary and Joseph. What's their role in the broader story?
Again, very good. Simeon and Anna. Anna was a prophetess. She doesn't actually speak, but we're told that she was 84. She was a widow. She lived in the temple all the time, praying and worshipping. And Simeon had been and revealed to him in his lifetime that he would get to live to see the Messiah. You see, the Old Testament, for about 2,500 years before Jesus was born, when it was started to be written, had numerous prophecies that the Messiah would be born. He'd be born in Bethlehem, that he'd be a Nazarene, that he'd be crucified between thieves, that he'd be buried in a rich man's grave. There's lots and lots of prophecies. And so they were expecting the Messiah. And Simeon was told that he would get to live to see the Messiah. So he was an old man. And when he sees Joseph and Mary coming into the temple on the eighth day to have the child circumcised, as it was being the custom, the presentation in the temple, he goes over to them and he takes the child and he says a famous prayer. So, "At last, all-powerful Master, you give leave to your servant to go in peace according to your promise. For my eyes have seen your salvation, which you prepared for all nations, the light to enlighten the Gentiles and give glory to Israel, your people." So what he's saying is, look, I now have seen the Messiah. I can go home and die. This is the prophecy fulfilled. But he says to Mary two things. He will bring you great joy, but he will also pierce your heart. And I'm wondering what a 16-year-old girl would have understood when he said that to her. And obviously, later on, we know what happens. She stands at the bottom of the cross, watching her son being bludgeoned to death, dying, hanging naked on a cross, how that must have pained her. And again, maybe at Christmas time, people have pain and suffering and loss. And that ties in with the Christmas story, that while there was great joy, there also was suffering for Mary at the end of all that. But through all that, she endured. And so you mentioned, what role had those two people to play, the two older people? It was that they again knew the scriptures and at the same time were willing to act on it and believe in it. Mm. So they were pretty significant in that sense, that they authenticated probably to Mary and Joseph that this was the child was Jesus was.
And also sense, I presume, like, you know, I've been in the company of and shook hands with people of the cloth, religious people, and I'm not going to sit here and pretend that I'm an incredibly religious person, right? But I have my faith in my own way. But sometimes you meet people And you feel there's something there, right? And that's very subjective. So I presume at this time also there were senses and feelings that people were leaning on to validate what they believed was happening or to fill in blanks for them. I just want to get to the one last mention of the three wise men, because they've been doing the hokey-cokey in this story, but I don't think I asked you about the three gifts and the significance of them. Yeah. Is that recorded biblically, or again, is that just a little bit of padding, relevant padding?
So you've hit the nail on the head. You see, it says that there were, and it doesn't actually say wise men. They call them magi in Latin, or magios, M-A-G-I-O-S in Greek, and it would have been written in Greek. And the nearest word we have to that is magician, but it's translated as wise men. And they came from Persia, we believe, probably traveled for a couple of months, would have had an entourage, maybe of 100 people. They were following a star. They were kind of star readers or astrologists of some kind. We're not 100% sure, but they were a priestly kind of class on whatever religion they were from.
And we also know at that time, sorry to interrupt you, that there were people incredibly connected to stars and star formations and what have you. And you only have to look at the pyramids, and I'm not sure how that fits into faith and timelines and what have you, but there were people that were able to plot these massive structures on the earth with incredible accuracy to within an inch. And a lot of that was using the stars. So that is not beyond the stars. That's not beyond the realms of possibility, what people may have seen or read from the stars.
Well, look at our own Newgrange. You're 100% correct. Newgrange, what, 3,200 BC? And it still works. It's a massive clock. And on the 24th of December, the sun rises. It goes up into the chamber. So obviously, they had a deep understanding, a mathematical understanding, and that would have been common at the time. You're quite correct. Whatever learned people that would be able to figure that out. We always think that we're pretty wise and smart now. And as you mentioned, the pyramids, God knows how they built Newgrange as well. It's really a mystery.
Well, no one knows how men and women of the time, predominantly men, presumably, constructed or worked this stuff out. It's simply unknown. For all the intelligence that there is in this world, no one could demonstrate or actually recreate without machinery the building of the pyramids. It simply is not doable. I don't know if you have an interest in them, but I'll do half an hour with you.
I do.
I'll do yeah. half an hour with yeah, you on that in a heartbeat. Don't worry about that.
Yeah, well, maybe we do them in Newgrange sometime. Okay. Yeah, it's fascinating.
Right, okay. So, and then the just to move.
The shepherd, you asked a question yes. about the gift. You see, there's mention of three gifts, and therefore people assume because there was three gifts brought to the manger or to Mary and Joseph that there was three wise men that went with them. But it doesn't actually give you the number of wise men. And these wise men went into Jerusalem, and then from Jerusalem they went to see Herod and told Herod, where's this Messiah to be born? We're following a star. And Herod says, God, I don't know. And he gets the Jewish people together, the priests, and he says, oh, it's in Bethlehem. So they go to Bethlehem, they find the child, and they go and they worship him. And you could imagine a 16-year-old girl as well, that these three strangers with their entourage parked up on the front lawn of your house, for example, and going in and not being able to speak their language. You could imagine she's very timid and shy. And you just wonder what kind of interaction
well,
was going on there.
Well, most basically, what is their motivation? Or
yeah,
whatever.
And her being confused. But they brought gold, which would symbolise that he was a king. Frankincense, the idea that he was divine, that's what that would symbolise. This is according to St. Irenaeus. And then myrrh is a spice that you use when you're burying someone. So the idea of that is death. So the whole idea of him being a king, Christ the king, the idea of him being divine, Jesus Christ overcomes death. And then myrrh is the idea of the crucifixion and his death. So that's what the symbolises. So that symbolises. And I wonder what she did with the gold.
Well, who's to say? You mentioned Herod, and every story needs a bad guy, and for many he is that bad guy. What do we know about him?
Actually, we know quite a lot about Herod. And Josephus, who was a Jewish historian, wrote about him in about the first century. So there's mention of him in the Bible, but there's also other historical documents. And he was appointed by the Roman Senate to Judea, part of where Jesus was born. And they called him the King of the Jews, which is ironic because Jesus later becomes the King of the Jews or crucified as King of the Jews. And he was a bit of a madman in the sense that he was very much into his own control and his own crown and his own authority and his own ego. Now, he built a lot of aqueducts and infrastructure. He was a great builder, but he was so gone on his own control of the kingdom that he actually had four of his family executed. He executed three of his sons and one of his wives. Because he felt threatened by them. And Caesar Augustus, who was the emperor at the time in Rome, had said of him was, it was better to be his pig than to be his son, because Herod was a Jew and Jews wouldn't eat pork. So he had a better chance of surviving if you were his pig than his son or his family member. But when he found out that Jesus was born, obviously through the wise men, he got the chief priests, scribes in Jerusalem together from the temple, say, look, where's this child to be born? Bethlehem. And so he sends his army down to Bethlehem to massacre all the boys under 2 years of age. It's called the Massacre of the Holy Innocents. And every year Catholics have a mass on the 28th of December to commemorate the Massacre of the Holy Innocents. Mm. So these were considered the companion. And Joseph had a dream shortly before that where Gabriel told him to get out of escaped from there, from Bethlehem, and he went into Egypt. So again, that's the chronology that's given to us. So that's Herod. Herod is the bad man. You don't see too many Herods in the dramas at Christmas.
No.
But yeah, I think he's still very important.
You don't see the name Herod used too much either. Right, so yeah. Your reflection then, we've drawn the picture, we've discussed the characters, and I use that phrase with no disrespect, in this story that we've leaned so heavily on for 1,500 odd years. What's your reflection then on all of your research and all the various characters and the roles in this, Joe?
Well, again, going back to what we said at the beginning, that the Gospels were written for adults and for at a spiritual and theological level. And there's one word that comes across in the whole thing, and I've had the privilege of studying Hebrew, and it's a very difficult language, but there's one word in it, Anawim, Anawim. And Anawim means that you're poor. Now, not necessarily financially poor, but poor in spirit. And if you look at all the main characters, with the exception of Herod, the shepherds, Mary, Joseph, Anna, Simeon, the wise men, even, they're poor in spirit. And what really is, what the challenge of the nativity story that Luke and Matthew are trying to get across is this. If you could imagine your life's like a glass, And if your life is full of yourself and your ego and all your wants and all your desires and materialism, and you fill your life up with all those things, then you're not poor in spirit. There's no space for God to work through you to become the person he's created you to be. This is the theological idea. That's where if you look at Joseph and Mary and the shepherds, for example, they were poor in spirit. Their glass wasn't full, if that makes sense. And God was able to fill them. And they said yes to God. And therefore, they became who they were meant to be. Mary becomes the mother of Jesus. Joseph becomes the father. The shepherds go and see the child. So the challenge that they put across is this idea of poverty. And later on, Jesus, when he does the 8 Beatitudes, he talks about happy are the poor, for they shall inherit the kingdom of heaven. And what he means by that is poor in spirit, that there's space in all of us. And maybe that's the question of Christmas. Where is the space in our lives for God? And can God work through us? Or have we our cup filled with our wants, our desires, and the cares of the world? And that's damn hard, yeah. Greg.
And hard you can fill those, that cup with priorities as well, because then it starts becoming emotional and a mental. Yeah. I'm going to read just a couple of texts, because the last one I enjoyed particularly, but I'll get to more of them after we finish. Joe Kelly, what a great guy. We've known Joe a lifetime, and he is a fantastic human being, a teacher, a friend, but a unique human being who can impart knowledge like turning on a tap. That comes in from Helen. And another one, this is the one I enjoyed. I enjoy them all, but I wish you'd give me more warning. He's coming on. I like to make the tea and sit and enjoy him. Well, you can listen to the podcast after 12:30 and have your cup of tea and enjoy it. Joe, I know you like your poetry and it is that time of year. I just wonder if you might indulge us with a Christmas poem to wrap things up.
Okay, a simple one maybe for children as well. And look, I just want to thank you, Greg and Caroline and Highland Radio, and to your listeners, and wish you all a happy Christmas. And thank you for all the lovely comments. And I get them even off air. So thank you very much. And it's good to think that, you know, we're part of people's lives in a positive way. And we need that as much as we can in Christmas time particularly. So look, to wish yourself, Bannock, in Highland, in the Dini League. So I'll read you a wee poem that I read for the children here. It's called The Baron. Oak moor and icicles grow on my nose. I'm tired of hearing the cows breathing and talking together. I'm sick of these clucking hens. I hate stables and winter weather. Hush, little coat, say the mare, and a story I will tell of a barn like this one of ours and the wonders that there befell. It was weather much like this, and the beast stood as we stand now, in the warm, good dark of the barn, a horse and an ass and a cow. And a sheep, asked the colt, yes, sheep, and a pig and a goat and a hen, all the beasts of the barnyard, the usual servants of men. And into their midst came a lady, and she was as cold as death, but the animals leaned above her and made her warm with their breath. There was her baby born and laid to sleep in the hay, while music flooded the rafters and barn was as light as day. And the angels and kings and shepherds came to worship the babe from afar. But we looked at him first of all creatures by the bright, strange light of a star. Gurumayagat.
Gurumayagat, Dr. Joe Kelly, a merry happy Christmas, or a very happy Christmas, sorry, to you, your family, and all of your students as well, and all in your community. All right, cheers. Joe, a pleasure as always. Take care of yourself. Look forward to chatting to you in 2025, if that's okay, and I'm sure it is. Okay, let me take a break. We'll be back with your comments to finish up this show. Right, now, restoration of Carndonagh Care Centre, restoration of Carndonagh Daycare Services. Tony Doherty is a spokesperson for this ongoing campaign. Tony, thanks for your time. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg, and thanks very much for having us on the show.
No, it's good to have you on. Thanks for accepting the invite. Right, so are we at the point now where we can look forward to Carndonagh Hospital Day Services for older persons coming back? Because, as you would know, it's been discussed extensively on this show and elsewhere, but we seem to have some firm information. What is that information?
So I suppose just to give you a very brief history, just for people, it won't take too long, Greg, is that we were without daycare services since COVID almost 5 years ago. There was a HICWA report which said that in the hospital it wasn't fit for purpose going forward. We then had a town hall meeting in the Colgan Hall where over 200 people turned up. That was October of last year. And they then gave a mandate for the committee to seek a meeting with Minister Mary Butler, who's a minister for older persons, to ask or maybe demand for the immediate reinstatement of daycare services. And that meeting took place last April. In fact, I think she was on your show on the same day. A meeting took place in Ballyshannon. And at that meeting, the minister said to us that the model going forward, Greg, was for a social care model. But she gave a commitment, should a suitable premises be found in Carndonagh, that she would provide the funding. That was the first thing, that was the first commitment. And the second thing was that our committee was given a mandate, if you like, through her to meet regularly with the HSE. So the whole focus of that was to find a suitable location then after that meeting in April. And we had meetings with the HSE, Frank Morrison, who's the head of older people's services in the northwest of the island. He would have chaired those meetings. We met in August, we met in October. And on December the 6th, which is the last meeting that we had just less than 2 weeks ago, there was a breakthrough in that insofar as the location has been found, which is the Spree of Sport, which you'd be well aware of that group in Carndonagh, or Spree as they're now called, and a building underneath the, in the, as part of the SuperValu complex in Carndonagh. And they have made it available Mondays, Tuesdays and every second Thursday available for a daycare service. Now, that's subject to a final fire approval report, but nobody at the meeting thought that that would be a problem. So what happens now, Greg, is that the HSE are going to put this service in place in the new year. We don't have a date yet. We have a meeting on the 10th of January with the HSE.
And Tony,
but going to be
in relation to that, that's really positive. You mentioned a three-month trial. Now, we've been involved in a number of these campaigns, and thankfully, you know, we've got to this stage whereby their services are going to be returned, but it's a trial basis. And often at that point, it comes very much to a use it or lose it stage. So the argument has to be made the HSE that these services are very much required, which we know they are, and that they're sustainable going forward and they justify the resources. So are we in a period of time now that if anyone feels they could benefit or their family could benefit from meeting old friends or making new ones, having a hot meal, enjoying the crack and chat, taking fun in activities and what have you, now is the time to register your interest and properly, formally register your interest so we can go back to the HSE with numbers that justify their commitment in this regard?
Well, you just said it there. You just summarised everything there, Greg. And just to add to that, right, as part of this three-month trial, what the HSE have come back to say to us is that they don't have any referrals at the moment. Now, we said, well, of course you have no referrals because the service has been closed for 5 years. So just what you just summarised there is we have to shake down now, and we have a big sort of media campaign that has started. We had a Facebook message that went out a couple of days ago. Huge response from that, Greg. We have 2,000 flyers made up, which are going out through the postal service this week. The scouts are getting involved in the masses at the weekend.
But you need all name and numbers, don't you? That's what you need. I'm sorry push it along a little bit, Tony. My apologies. I hope you don't believe I'm being
not
ignorant.
At all.
But it's names and numbers that's needed now, actual people that to be referred to the services. And is that done via the public health nurse who assesses needs and makes referrals? Is that how this is going to be done on this occasion?
That's how it's going to be done. So what we need people to do is to, if you have a loved one or a neighbour, you need to phone up your public health nurse. And you'll probably get an answering machine because they're very busy, but rest assured that they will get back to you. Now, a couple of the public health nurses have got back to us in the last couple of days to say that there's been a lot of people who have phoned up, thankfully, but some people haven't left their name or haven't left their phone number. So just to tell people out there, if you're one of those people who phoned up and you didn't leave your name or maybe you forgot to leave a phone number, please do that. You've got to leave your... And someone from the HSE will be back shortly.
Right, in the new year, this service will be available Mondays and Tuesdays and every second Thursday from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. at Unit 6 Spree SuperValu Carndonagh. It is an amazing facility that has been hard fought for. As you can hear from Tony and the rest of the committee, lots and lots of meetings, lots of interviews, lots of everything else. But you have to register if you're in the Carndonagh area, the Clonmany area, Coldaff, Glenelly, Malin, Mobile. Register with your local public health nurse. We are going to stick the numbers on our Facebook page. It might go to an answer machine, but ring the numbers, leave your name, leave your number. Someone will get back to you. It's incredibly important now that this battle is won and that the numbers are there to justify it, and that this comes becomes not just a 3-month trial, but a permanent restoration of services. And there's no doubt, Tony, the demand is out there. We're now trying to connect the demand to the health nurses so they can make the referrals, and this can be up and running and as busy as it should be. I hope we touched on everything there, Tony. We'll talk again if you need another push in the new year. Let me know. But for now, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks very much, Greg, for your support, and happy Christmas.
Happy Christmas to you and everyone. Tony Doherty there, their restoration of Carndonagh Day services. I'll get the numbers for the various public health nurses' offices up on our socials. Ring them up. If you've got a loved one, or indeed you can self-refer, I'm sure, ring them up. Leave your name and your number. There's a 3-month trial of these services in Carndonagh. Use it or lose it is perhaps the message that coming from me is probably a little bit harsh, but you know it's intended. It's very well intended. Okay, anything we didn't get to today, we're going to carry over to tomorrow. It's our usual Friday show, but as it's Christmas, we've got a couple of shows on the road tomorrow. We are being hosted by the Gallen Hotel Group. We're celebrating their 12 days of Christmas. I'll tell you, we're also going out at the start of next week as well for a very special show. So stay tuned for all of that. That's all coming up tomorrow and then into next week. I'll chat to you tomorrow, as I say, from 9. We've got our Friday panel. We've got That's Entertainment. We've got loads of live entertainment, fun and giveaways. You won't want to miss it. Thank you to everybody who contributed to today's show. We've had the peaks where it's been joyous, and we've had the moments of reflection where we try and limit as much as possible loss and heartbreak over this period of time. But that's a reflection of us. The show, I think, sometimes holds a mirror up to us as individuals. So I hope you enjoyed it in its whole. Stay safe.